How do you build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects, candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
So today is a very special day, and we have a truly legendary guest with us. But before we start, I want to share a brief story with our listeners because it gives context to why our guest, Hort Schulze, is so important to this conversation. Many people know that we teach a fundamental system, and the origin to all of this is that some almost 20 years ago, it was actually 2003, I was running another company. It was an employee benefits consulting company. It was very successful, and we were known for extraordinary service. And yet, I wanted to find ways that we could elevate our game and be even better than we were. And so what I did is I closed our office one day and I took my entire staff of 100 or so people on buses from southern New Jersey, where I live, over to Center City, Philadelphia. And I took everybody to the Ritz-Carlton because everybody knows that nobody does service like Ritz-Carlton. And at the time that I did this, some almost 20 years ago, I didn't know much about how Ritz-Carlton did it. I just knew they were amazing. And I asked them if maybe during lunch they could have someone share with us some of the behind-the-scenes practices that enabled them to be so successful. And they, of course, were happy to do so. And they had someone from their HR department share with us two things that I would not be exaggerating if I were to say to you that the two things that I learned that day were to change the course of the rest of my career. I learned about something, and you'll learn about it today, that Ritz-Carlton calls their basics, a series of service standards or behaviors that they teach, and something that they call the daily lineup, a way of practicing these day after day after day in every property around the world. And when I learned about these things that day, some, I think it was 2003, it struck a chord in me, and I thought, this is brilliant. We've got to be able to do something like this in my company. And I created what I called our fundamentals, and a weekly cycle that we began to practice them. And that's the system that I've written books about and that I've taught to thousands and thousands of leaders since then. But none of it would have ever happened had it not been for my experience learning this from the Ritz-Carlton. Well, our guest today is Horst Schulze. Horst is truly a legend and a leader in the hotel world. And Horst was the founder, one of the founders, and the original CEO of Ritz-Carlton, and Horst was the creator of their basics and their daily lineup and the service standards and all the things they've done that make them such an outstanding and amazing organization. During his tenure, Horst was the president, and he was responsible for $2 billion of operations worldwide. Under his leadership, they were the first two-time winners of the National Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award. He's been recognized as the Hotelier of the Year. He's been given an honorary Doctor of Business Administration and Hospitality Management. He's been honored as the Leader in Luxury by Travel Agent Magazine. I mean, there is nobody who knows more about service than Horst Schulze. So we are truly honored to have Horst as our guest today. Horst, thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be with you. Thank you. That was a great introduction. I want you to do that all the time now.
I'll take you. You can take me wherever you go. But true, I'm not exaggerating when I say the things that I learned led to everything that I teach people today. Let's go back to a little bit of history here. So I know from your background, but our audience probably doesn't know, that you're one of these weird people that from an early age, you decided, I want to be in the hospitality business. So like, how did that, like, who decides at a young age you want to be in the hospitality business? Tell us about that story.
I wonder who does, but it's kind of really strange. For some reason, and I don't know why, and my parents didn't know why, I went to them when I was 11 years old, and they said, you know, I want to work in the hotel business. And they said, yeah, okay, and because didn't take that serious, but I kept on talking about it, insisting on it, begging about it. Now, mind you, that was very unusual. I grew up in a small village in Germany. I had never been in a hotel. I had never been in a restaurant before. That was after war years. But I keep on begging, and there was no honor in doing that. Like being a butcher or a roofer, that would have been honorable. Or in Germany, if you would have been a blacksmith or a technician or architect, now that would have been honor for the family. My grandfather was embarrassed But I insisted on it, and my parents then looked into it and decided, well, the only way to make that successful for him to find the best hotel in the region to work in. So I left home, actually, when I was 14, to work in the best hotel in the region. Unfortunately, that was 100 kilometers away. And at that time, that was very far.
Mm-hmm.
So I started work in that hotel as a busboy when I was 14.
Wow. And you've stayed in that industry your entire life.
Yeah, it was really impactful starting there. I in the meantime, my parents understand, you know, I lived in a dorm room in that hotel and worked. Mm-hmm. They told me before I went there, we could never go to a hotel like that. This is a hotel that's only for important ladies and gentlemen. Behave yourself accordingly. And when I got there, my mother told me, and the general manager met us, and he told me the same thing. Now, this is for very important ladies and gentlemen. Don't get envious. You are here for only one reason, to help them and serve them and to learn how to do that and so on. Then the next, I met the maitre d', which was life-changing moment. I didn't know it at the time, of course. He said, all right, tomorrow morning, show up at 7 o'clock. If I meant 1 minute after 7, I would tell you, 7 o'clock, be here, be precise, and don't come to work. What? He said, come here to be excellent in what you're doing. I didn't get that. Well, mind you, that went over my head, 14 years old. But it impacted my life. And then because from there on, working with this maitre d' for 3 years, I learned what excellence is. He was a human being of excellence. I left after 3.5 years to go and work in Switzerland, hotel business. And before I left, he said, look me in the eyes. Never go to work for work. Always go to create excellence in what you're doing. Impacted my life, totally.
Wow. And probably why you chose the title Excellence Wins for your book.
Well, I started that, man. I mean, and I learned and looked at what does it mean, excellence, because it always was part of every word that he used. And as he was an example of it. And I realized, and people respected him highly, and I realized by his excellence, he defined himself mm-hmm. as somebody special. By his excellence, he was respected by everybody, guests and employees alike. So I learned that you define yourself every day at work. You define yourself. You have the opportunity. Let's face it, you don't define yourself when you're at home watching TV. And I realized because of him that if I work, while I'm creating excellence, I get paid, and I have the opportunity while I'm being paid to define myself as a person. I found all that very exciting.
Uh-huh. So you grow up in this industry, you have this influential maitre d' who teaches you about excellence. Eventually, you worked your way toward the Ritz-Carlton. You had shared with me once before the story, but share for our audience briefly. So how did somebody came to you and said, hey, we want to start this new hotel chain. Tell me about how that happened.
Yeah. Maybe I share with you one more follow-up story.
Sure.
I finally worked, after leaving the maitre d', I worked in the finest hotels in Europe. I mean, truly, in Switzerland, and worked in Paris for 3 years, and worked in London. And then I came to the U.S., came to the San Francisco in the Hilton, worked as room service waiter, with the total intent to go back after I would get a promotion to room service supervisor to Europe and follow my career there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a point of my working that I should have that promotion. And I knew I would get that promotion because I knew I was by far the best waiter in room service. And the room service manager was German too, so I had an in and everything and so. And guess what? Sure enough, a room service supervisor left a few months later, and I didn't get the job.
Mm.
Well, the first reaction was pain, embarrassment, ego, and management is stupid not to give me that job, kind of. But it took me a few months to admit the other guy deserved it more. You see, I was young. I partied a lot in the evening. We had to start working at 6 o'clock in the morning. When I showed up, a few minutes late, mind you, only a few minutes, mind you, and tired, you could see from 100 yards that I was tired. And when the manager asked, would you do this side work over here, like folding napkins, I said, why me, why not the other guys? The guy that got a promotion never showed up late. He smiled when he walked in. He said, I'm happy to do this side work. And when I come to this acceptance, I went back to my little furnished room in the Tenderloin district in San Francisco. Yes. And I talked to the maitre d'. He wasn't there, mind you. He had passed away, and he didn't show up as a ghost either. But I talked to him, and I apologized, and I realized I went to work to work.
Instead of for excellence.
I promised you never to do that, and I will never do it again. Wow. And from there on, my career took off like a rocket ship. And from there on, became hired as a corporate vice president. I was regional vice president, became corporate vice president for all food and beverage operations in the United States operations. And then somebody called and said, we're starting a new hotel company. Would you join us? We are developers. We need an operator to run the company. We are developers of financial people. We need you to come and run this company. I wasn't interested, but finally they promised me I could do what I want. So I started to have a vision to create the finest hotel company in the world. And I said, if you let me do that my way, they said, yeah, it's up to you. Come in and do it. We purchased the Ritz-Carlton Boston, which was a dilapidated old hotel. But we took the name because it was registered globally. We took the name against the recommendation of our marketing people, and so on. They said, that is crazy, that is a bad name, dilapidated hotel. But a little bit over a year later, we opened our first hotel in Atlanta, and then our second hotel, also in Atlanta, strategically not very smart. And then a year later, we reopened the Ritz-Carlton Boston, which we had closed for renovation because it was a terrible rundown hotel. And the rest is history. 3 years later, we were voted best hotel company in America. 2 years later, we were voted best hotel company globally. When I left, we had hotels in 5 continents and was voted number one hotel company. Not only that, it was number one brand in the world.
Wow, that's impressive. So take me back to when you started operating the Ritz-Carlton, when did you decide to create the service standards, the basics, and the daily lineup? Where was that in the history?
Well, very, very early. I mean, mind you, I worked in the hotel business now for the rest of for my whole life. I had made a decision, very simple. My purpose would be to create the finest hotel company in the world. Mm-hmm. I questioned myself truly, carefully, would that purpose, that vision be good for all concerned? Would it be good for the investor? Would it be good for the customer? Would it be good for every employee? And would it serve society as a whole? I didn't just simply answer that question. Very carefully agonized about it. Would it be good? Yes. Why would it be good? I came to the conclusion, yes, that would be good. Now I had a vision, a purpose, and I knew it would be good. Now, clearly, I now had the obligation to pursue this because it would be good for all concerned. Mm-hmm. So now I had to make a decision how I'm going to accomplish that. So I looked at what would I have to do? What would be the 20 things I would have to do to make that happen? How would I be superior to the competition? Who is the competition? So out of that, as we were opening our first hotel, we developed the 20 steps, the 20 basics, the 20 gold standards that would make us accomplish this vision of being the leader in the hotel industry.
Okay.
And that's how we established. We looked at what, based driven by the customer, mm-hmm. by the employees, what would make us better relative to the employees, relative to the customers. And we adopted those 20 basics, which we consequently taught fully the second day of orientation of new employees mm-hmm. in a new hotel and fully taught this. And then we kept them alive. We discuss one of those basics every single day in every hotel. Mind you, before every shift, and mind you, we're 24-hour business. Mm-hmm. Hotel never closes. So those 20 points were taught over and over and over again. Like for example, today maybe when number 12, a very simple thing, but we knew it was important based on customer feedback. Number 12 is, if a guest asks for direction, escort the guest, don't point. Mm-hmm. But we also taught, mind you, while you escort the guest, create a relationship. Ask him, how do you like your stay in the hotel? Have you tried our restaurant before? Everybody recommends it. So have conversation selling the hotel, if you will, mm-hmm. while you escort him. So that's number 12. Mm-hmm. So in 20 days, that will be repeated again. You listen to it today in every shift for everybody in every hotel around the world. And in 20 days, you have to listen to it again.
So let me ask you this, Horst, because I get this question. When we talk about our fundamentals, which are patterned in the same kind of concept, most of our clients have somewhere between 25 and 30 behaviors or fundamentals. And we've done this with hundreds and hundreds of companies. And one of the common questions that I'll get from people at first, and I can explain it to them, but their first response is, that's too many. You know, we shouldn't have more than a few things because people aren't going to remember that. Did you face that question when you first rolled out your basic? Oh, this is too many. We can't do 20 things.
Not only that. First, the question was, you must be kidding me. We have to follow that. We're not, that's like a Bible. We're not a religion. Wait a minute. This is the 20 things which will make us superior to everybody else in the industry. And that is good for all concerned. I cannot compromise that. Those 20 things you will learn and will be part of you. Not just will you learn it, it will be front of your mind all the time. That's why I will remind you of it, one of those 20 every single day. Mm-hmm. If you like, in fact, I told the managers after I noticed they didn't do it because they thought, well, everybody knows it by now. They didn't repeat it every day anymore. And so to make it very clear to the manager, if you don't repeat it every day, one of them, to every employee, before every shift, I will fire you. Mm-hmm. Because I have no right as the leader to compromise this. This will make us number one. And being number one, everybody will benefit. And I'm here to serve everybody. I cannot compromise that.
And so did you have situations where people weren't doing it and you fired them?
Of course, yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, yes.
I bet that sent a loud, clear message.
Well, as I made it very clear, if we don't live by those rules, if in any location we're not voted number one, that's what we have to be. In order to be the best in the world, in every location you have to be number one. I will move into the hotel, and we measure that constantly. If you're not number one for 3 months in a row, I will move in the hotel and correct it. Hmm. And I did that too. Yes.
Wow.
As the leader, you have to accept your responsibility. My total responsibility was to every employee, not to one individual, to everybody, and to every investor, and to society, and to every guest. So I have no right to compromise this.
That's pretty powerful. So when you started this, and again, to your point, people thought, oh, we can't do it all. This is religious. This is like the Bible. And this is, you're telling me to do these things. Yes. And you insisted, no, this is what we're going to do. How long do you think, if you remember, how long did it take until you stopped hearing that resistance and people just got on board and recognized, you know, Horst isn't kidding around. He's pretty serious about this.
Well, frankly, several years. Mm-hmm. It's about 3 or 4 years. Okay. And because in the beginning, I didn't realize that people didn't started not doing it and so on. So the first thing I did was when I realized, I walked into a hotel and there were the waiters and I walked into the restaurant. They didn't know I was coming. I was shopping next door. Walked into a hotel. The when in the restaurant, the waiters and the maitre d' were staying together. And so I said, oh, you're discussing the gold standard of the day? Well, no, we are discussing how many reservations. I said, well, did you talk about the gold standard today? Well, not today, but we all know it. I said, whoa. And then I talked to the general manager, and he said, well, you know, Horst, everybody is kind of, we feel kind of silly to repeat when they all know it. So I got every channel manager together and asked the question, okay, is anybody of you who doesn't know Coca-Cola, tell me so? I said, tell me, there must be somebody who doesn't know it, or you all know it. But guess what? Coca-Cola knows that you all know it. Yet they spend $5 billion a year to promote their name. So why do you think they do that, to keep it front of mind? So why wouldn't we keep front of mind the very thing that will make us the best in the world and will serve everybody?
Mm.
Since you don't do it now, I take the next. Since you didn't do it by yourself, I will take the next step. I will tell you, if I find one hotel who is not doing it, I will fire you.
Wow.
Period. Because I have no right to compromise that. I have no right. And from there on, it happened, begrudgingly. And then, all of a sudden, of course, the recognition that everybody got, we were recognized as number one. We got the applause. Everybody got the applause. Everybody got the honor. There was no more question. We were number one. That people wanted to work for us. So while the industry couldn't find any people to work, we had people staying in line to work for us. So the results were there, and of course, then you had buy-in, and then you had all of a sudden the people who in the beginning were embarrassed and hated that they were all of a sudden the developer of the idea.
Wow.
You know, that always happens.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's still people outside telling the story how they did it. They were the very ones who hated it.
That's funny. This is an interesting sort of perspective. So I know that somewhere along the line at Ritz-Carlton, not only did you do all these things, but you also taught or created a unit or a division or some segment of the company that also taught other businesses how to do these kinds of things. And in fact, I actually went to those. So here's my first question for you about that. So some would say that seems kind of crazy. I mean, I could be the Hyatt Regency, and I could go to Ritz-Carlton's headquarters and they will teach me how to do their things. They must be crazy. So why did you do that?
Well, let me tell you the truth about it. We applied for the Baldrige Award because I wanted to look. After we were voted number one in America, we had only 5 or 6 hotels. I realized we are voted number one, but we had a lot of guest comments, negative guest comments still. We had a lot of guys that didn't think we were that great. Mm-hmm. When I had that conversation with Roger Milligan of Milligan Carpet, and he said, I understand what you mean. He said, he had told me, congratulations, best hotel company, bought the best hotel company in the world again, in America again at the time. I said, yes, Mr. Milligan, maybe we are the best, but we are not good. If we are the best, we're the best of a lousy lot. We have a lot of complaints. And he said, I understand what he's saying. You should look into the Baldrige criteria, which I didn't know what that was at all. And he set me up with the Commerce Department, and there's the Baldrige criteria that we studied that and realized that's continuous improvement, becoming better and better and so on. And then we applied for the Baldrige Award, which was the highest excellence award in America for best-run organizations. We won it, but one obligation that you have if you win it is to teach others.
Mm-hmm.
That is an obligation that you sign up for. So we set up, but frankly, I manipulated it in a way. Yeah, it's simpler start that we would make some money from it, even we're not allowed to charge for 2 years, for the first 2 years. So we started our teaching session in Atlanta at the time. It's 7 a.m. Monday mornings. This way you had to check in Sunday night into our hotel. So we made our money. Well, you know.
That's funny.
We know. Come on, I'm in business. But it developed slowly into a business, because after 2 years, we were allowed to charge. And the companies that came to us became loyal customers to ours. Mm-hmm. So we taught thousands of companies came in. And every week we had 10, 20 companies there to learn our criteria. We talk about, for example, companies like Disney World. They send so many people in, you have no, can't believe it, to learn from us. All kind of companies that you know came in. Apple came in to learn, and mm-hmm. they even said that they built their retail around our philosophy, around this teaching. And so they became our customers. So we that's why we became the number one brand eventually in the world at the time.
Mm-hmm. As a side comment here, two people from my company back 18, 20 years ago, we went to Chevy Chase, Maryland, to the location there and took the class. And one of the things that stood out to me, I still remember this so many years ago, was watching the leaders do the daily lineup in the office environment. As I recall, there was a two-story atrium there, and everybody came out of their office and gathered around at 9 o'clock, and the guests who were there for the class, and we all gathered around, and we did the daily lineup. And it showed me that it was real for them, not just at a hotel property, but even in the office.
Oh, sure. In our corporate office, come on, in our corporate office 9:02 every morning, we all met mm-hmm. in one corner. And had our daily lineup, the same one that was taking place today in every hotel and every department around the world. Wow. The same thing, and we shared it. And in the beginning, the leaders did. In the beginning, I did it, then some other managers. Pretty soon, the employee said, hey, I like that one. Can I do it? And so everybody did it. And after a while, it became exciting, and it was everybody adapted to it and was part of everybody.
Wow.
And mind you, at the same time, we always shared what is going on in the company so that people feel part of the company. What's going on in the company? We shared today a letter, the same letter from a customer that was applauding us all. We shared the same letter around the world. We shared the same message. We just signed a new hotel in Shanghai. Everybody knew that. Everybody felt part of the company. And everybody felt part of the vision of the company.
You eventually, after doing all of this at Ritz-Carlton, setting the new standard, becoming the number one brand in the world, I mean, it's a lot of accomplishment. Ritz-Carlton gets sold to Marriott. You spend a few years there.
Part of the deal was that I had to stay 5 years.
Yeah. So you spend 5 years there and then move on, and you created a new hotel chain. Is that correct?
Yeah.
You're not very good at retiring.
I actually want to retire. I'm not kidding you. My wife convinced me. I was traveling 250 days a year. Uh-huh. My wife convinced me it's enough. So I retired on a Friday. I'm not kidding. On the weekend, I talked to my neighbor who retired also, same time, but he's 15 years younger. So I said, why did you retire? So why did you retire already? I said, well, I wanted so I have time to do the things I love to do. So thinking about that over the weekend, what do I love to do? And I realized I love to play hotel. On Monday, I told my wife, I'm going to do it one more time. I'm going to create another hotel company. And she was upset for a moment. And and a few days later, I mean, I have a wonderful wife. I'm in love with her after 43 years. But she came to me a few days later and said, hey, that's who you are. And if you want to do that, I will support you. So on Monday, I went out already looking for an office, got an office, and looked to start a new hotel company, which is Capella, which, by the way, was a few months ago was voted the best hotel company in the world. There you are. Ritz-Carlton was best hotel company nearly all the year, number one, number two, for nearly all the years that I was running it. And now it is Capella, which I, by the way, sold 2 years ago, but it is still the philosophy and it's number one in the world now.
When you created Capella, did you create a similar set of service standards in a daily lineup?
Yeah, but slightly different. Mm-hmm. Very careful, get around this new market I want to serve. What I want to do, create an ultra-luxury hotel company. Not luxury, ultra-luxury. Mm-hmm. There were hotels like that, like the Plaza Athénée in Paris or the Claridge's in London and the Beauvais Palace in Lausanne or so on. They were single hotels. I want to do what they do as single hotels, smaller, no conventions, individual traveler, high end. I want to create that as a company. And I started that. In the meantime, other companies, that didn't exist. And we soon were the luxury, ultra luxury hotel company. So I didn't do anything really new. I just went into the more of the individualized business, because that was happening around the turn of the century. I knew that Shetty Power, who did our surveys, told me something's happening. There was, all of a sudden, there was a demand for ultra luxury. For example, If you would have asked 20 years ago, what's the real luxury car? 99% of people would have said Nelly Mercedes. If you would ask now, there are quite a few that would say Bentley. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to do. And that was became clear at the time that that was happening. And I wanted to do that. And sure enough, had a lot of fun doing it. But a couple of years ago, I sold the company. That's why now I did that before already, consult and work and make speeches relative to how to create that luxury in an organization, any organization.
Excellent. Well, that's something I want to dig into next, but we have to stop right here. Coming up in the second part of my conversation with Horst Schulze, who was one of the founding members of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company, Horst talks about what he's learned that every CEO should be responsible for.
I believe that the CEO, the leader of the company, I have to delegate nearly everything. But what I didn't delegate are two things. That is the vision of the company and the standards of the company.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Be sure to join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders from all walks of life. To book David for your events or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of Forbes Books.